Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter, the latest, greatest adventure of what's happening on life on planet Porky, with myself, of course, the Porkmeister, and the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Ms. Jones, so great to be talking and working with you again. You've been on your adventures in Italy, and I want to hear all about that. But I think, first of all, we've just got to focus a little bit, haven't we, on the political scene, because there's bombshells dropping all over the place. Who knows, by the time this podcast comes out, a few hours into the future, Boris might have gone.
I completely get why so many millions of people are so anti him, Rishi Sunak and this government, and want their heads to roll and all that. But there's one focus at the moment which we can't take our eyes off, which is Ukraine. There is a war on. This is a crisis of global proportions, and we have to make that our priority. And this is not the time, however we might feel, to be changing our government.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with you. I'm a big Boris supporter anyway. I think he gets the big issues right, and I think he dismisses the trivial issues such as Partygate, which is something else he's got to contend with now, in addition to the cost of living crisis and everything. And I don't think trivia interests him. And he left it to somebody else. But, you know, there you go. It's horses for courses and all that sort of thing. But let's get back to your trip to Italy. It sounds to me like you had a fantastic time, Miss Jones. You sent out a number of great images of these magnificent churches and art galleries and all sorts of things. Whereabouts in Italy were you, and why were you there?
I was with my eldest daughter, Mia, in Florence. And the reason we went to Florence, I'd never been there before, you know, of all the places I've been to all over the world, I couldn't work out why have I never been to Florence before. And it's because the rock and roll industry never took me there. There was never a major concert by a rock superstar to go there for. And that was the bulk of my traveling when we were in our sort of pomp on Fleet Street, if you like. So I just never got around to going. But my son Henry is on tour in a musical at the moment called The King of Rock. He's playing Elvis Presley, the young Elvis.
That is fantastic.
Yeah, and they're going from city to city all over Italy. So the day before we saw him in Florence, he'd been in Rome. He was in the Vatican that Sunday, sort of doing the tour of the Vatican and so on. And we caught up with him in Florence. We saw the show the next day. And then we had a few days to kill. They were on the road again. They were off to Treviso, I think, the next day, and then sort of moving on around the country. And they've still got
another. Is this production in English, by the way?
Yes, it is, yeah.
And the Italians don't mind that, then?
Well, no, because if you think about it, all the operas that we go and see in this country, in England, are in Italian or French. Yeah. And yes, you get sear titles above the sort of proscenium arch where you can, most people know the stories of the operas that they go and see. But that's all in foreign language, and we accept that as English people. But I think this is all part of teaching Italians English. Mm-hmm. The bulk of the audiences are students.
Yeah.
And they hold a Q&A after the show. So all the artists come down and sit along the front of the stage.
Right.
My Henry goes around in his gold suit with a microphone.
Yeah.
And he does this fantastic introduction in Italian. And I'm so impressed. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's really good.
Well,
and then they throw it open to the floor and he goes around and asks the questions. Mm. And there was this great moment when they say, one of them stands up and says, "How come you didn't do the song Can't Help Falling in Love with You?" One of Elvis's great classics. And Henry says, "Well, there are so many Elvis songs. You know, the writer of this production.
Wise men say."
Well, that's the one. That is the one. So he said the writer, you know, chose the songs, put the piece together. Yeah. There are just so many. And so I yelled out, "Sing it now." Mm-hmm. And Henry, being the classic professional that he is, just launches into the song and he says, "Come on, everybody, I'll sing it if you sing it." And so the whole theatre was singing this song back to him. It was, I was very moved by that.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah. Well,
but then we had a few days to do Florence. Yeah. And of course, this is the crucible of art in the entire world.
Yes.
This is the seat of the Renaissance and the great sort of medieval age of religious art and paintings, and Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, Botticelli. So there were a couple of Botticelli.
I always think that's a disease, pages. But I get it mixed up with botulism.
Botticelli, we used to say, is a cold bum. The same as, if you get it,
Botticelli.
The same as innuendo is an Italian suppository.
Yes, right. Oh, dear me.
Yeah, moving swiftly on. Oh, yes, and so we see all this, and I wanted to see The Birth of Venus, the great Botticelli painting. You know,
and
the
Venus
one
was her name. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That was a famous song.
Who by?
Venus was her name.
She's got it. Bananarama did that one.
Yeah,
I can't remember the original.
It was done first, I think, by a group called Europe or Europa or something. Yeah, anyway.
Long time ago. That was I'm Your Venus, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right, yes.
Yeah, there's a limerick we could come up with here.
No, I don't think we will. No, thank you.
For the sake of appropriateness, we probably won't. No, family show. So she's rising out of the shell with all her glorious hair and her modestly covered nakedness. Mm. It's a huge painting, and it's so impressive, and I'm so happy to have seen it live, as it were. And then, of course, we go and see Michelangelo's David, which is the famous statue in the Galleria dell'Accademia, which is so impressive.
Yeah.
And people sit there for hours sort of contemplating his genitals. Mm. Why are they so small his hands are so big and his feet are so big? And why has he got a tea towel over his shoulder? Of course, it's not a tea towel. It is a sling.
Yeah.
Because David famously slayed the giant Goliath.
That's right.
Just with a little sling and a stone.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the Ponte Vecchio, the great bridge over the Arno River. Ooh. Just so much to see.
Yeah.
And I've been here for the first time. Now I have to go again.
Ah.
You know, it has that effect on
you. Yeah, exactly. You went to somewhere called the Uffizi or somewhere. I thought it was a nightclub, but apparently it's a very famous museum, yeah?
No, darling. It's the world's oldest and most famous and best art gallery.
Oh, is it?
It's the Uffizi. And this is where all those great paintings reside.
No, Uffizi. Yeah, yeah.
You have to go. You would be blown away by it. It's gorgeous.
Not sure I would. I have been to the Vatican. Is that where the Sistine Chapel is?
Yeah.
And the roof of that's painted by Michelangelo, isn't it?
The ceiling, yes, the inside.
Yeah, the inside, yeah, the ceiling, that's what I meant, yeah. But I thought that was quite impressive, but I've also been to the painted hall at the Royal Naval College, Greenwich, where Nelson's body lay in state for 5 days after he was brought back in a barrel of whiskey from the Battle of Trafalgar, where he lost his life, but conquered the French and the Spanish. And I have to say, the painted hall, I don't know who painted it, actually. I don't think it was Michelangelo. No, it couldn't have been.
It wouldn't have been Michelangelo.
No, I don't think it was.
A little bit after the fact, I think.
Yes, it was, yeah. I mean, the Battle of Trafalgar was 1805, and it was painted in his honour after that, so...
Yes, about 400 years too late. Yeah. But I wonder who painted that one, then. I haven't seen that.
Trying to remember, because I do know. I mean... It was somebody like John Constable or somebody, but it wasn't John Constable, if you know what I mean. It must be difficult painting a ceiling because I suppose most of the time you have to lie on your back, do you, on a scaffolding or something like that.
Well, I tell you what else we saw in Florence.
Yeah.
My great friend from school, Karen, who lives in Luxembourg.
Oh, yes.
Her daughter, Layla, had been in Florence for the last
4 years. Layla!
Oh, God, he's off today, isn't he? Yeah. She spent the last 4 years training as an art restorer in Florence.
Yeah.
That was her degree. Yeah. And we went to this amazing monastery to see, it's called the Badia, and to see these two paintings that Layla herself restored.
Right.
And one of them is really, really high up in this monastery, high up on the wall. And she spent 9 months of her life lying flat on her back on scaffolding, cleaning and restoring this particular painting.
Good God.
We were so impressed. Mm. I've known this little girl since she was born, and she's now a professional art restorer. I'm just so proud of her.
Golly, that is dedication, isn't it? Absolutely.
I mean, some people spend their lives flat on their backs for other reasons.
Oh, now, come on, Miss Jones. Once again, you know, any opportunity just to, you know, get into the you know, the bit of murky world of, you know, horizontal refreshment and all that. Take the opportunity, don't
well, you?
You
know more about that than I do.
Well, no, I mean, we're talking about people being allegedly horizontal, but not on their backs. In fact, they are on their backs, I suppose, but there we go. Now,
you lie on your front, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Miss Jones, let me tell you, I've been very impressed by reading a piece by Miss Christine Bleakley, who now, in fact, is Miss Christine Lampard. She's married.
Or Mrs. Lampard.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, she's married to Frank Lampard. And I was really taken by the fact that she talked about the strains and the stresses of living 250 miles apart, because now Frank, who is the manager of my football club, Everton, lives on Merseyside most of the week, 6 days a week out of seven, probably. And she lives down in London. They decided not to move the family, because they've got quite a nuclear family, as I'll explain in a minute, not to move the family up to the Northwest. Frank went to America and played for a team in America. I can't remember which one it is, I'm sorry. I think it was New York. And they lived there for 2 years while he played there. And she said that, you know, the turmoil and the disruption to their children's lives, you know, having to go to different schools and make different friends, all that kind of stuff, was too much. But what most impressed me about her, because she's a working mother, she still appears on television a lot, she fills in for Lorraine, she does Loose Women, all that kind of stuff, was that she's actually mother to four children. Her and Frank have got two little ones, three and one, but there are daughters, 16 and 17, I think, from Frank's first relationship with a Spanish model called, I've forgotten her name now, to whom she's stepmother, and it seems to work out terribly well. She talked about her pride and her joy when she saw the 16 and 17-year-olds babysitting the younger ones and how the younger ones loved their elder sisters. And I thought it was all quite charming and, you know, very much a modern marriage. And the 6 days apart must be quite stressful.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's more to it than that, of course, because those two elder girls, they still have a mother with whom they live half the week, because the courts in the UK today tend not to award custody to one sole parent.
Yeah.
They tend to want to see co-parenting. Mm-hmm. So kids have to spend half the week with the mum and half the week with the dad, or whatever the arrangement is. There's another aspect to this, which is that those girls being 16 and 17, one will be doing her GCSEs and one will be doing her A-levels or preparing for them. As you rightly say, it's very, very tough on kids to be disrupted in their education and dragged off to different schools. And if those girls are coming to live with them for half the week, which I tend to think is unfair on children. Children need one stable home. They don't need to be packing their bags all the time and rushing off to mum's. Oh, God, I've left this at dad's. I need X textbook and I've left it at mum's. Whatever it is. It's very, very hard to expect children to do that. I'm not sure it's entirely the fairest way to do it, and I'm not sure what the answer is. But I do fear for this Lampard marriage, I have to say.
You said this earlier. And, you know, it's almost like putting a curse on it, isn't it?
No, I had this very experience. My husband, just soon after our youngest child was born, so she was just a couple of months old, he took a job in Poland. So every Sunday afternoon, he would fly to Warsaw, then take a connecting flight to Wrocław. He was supposed to come back on a Friday night. Sometimes that became Saturday morning if the plane was cancelled or delays or whatever. So we'd get him for 24 hours a week. And I had a new baby, a toddler, and a 10-year-old and a job. You know, I was a working mom, same as everybody else. So of course, tensions would build throughout the week. There'd be rows and there would be secrets and there would be suggestions of infidelities and there would be bus stops. And effectively, I was a single mother of three kids trying to work and do everything else. And of course, it ended in disaster. And I've spoken to a lot of people about this over the years. And long-distance marriages, ultimately, the couple pay the price. You've just, if you're married, you've got children, you've got to be together and you've got to go wherever one of the couple's job takes you. And you've got to stick together. Otherwise, temptations creep in, things go wrong. One person is bearing the brunt of all the child rearing. The other person is having time off, let's say, because Frank Lampard isn't managing Everton around the clock.
Oh, yes, believe me.
That's no, he gets to go to sleep and he gets to not have to get up in the night because a child is sick or whatever. So, you know, parenting needs both people to be totally committed to that period of time. It doesn't last very long.
I remember when Frank got the job at Chelsea, because he was manager at Derby, did pretty good job there, and then he was, I think most people accept he was promoted too soon to become the Chelsea manager. He wasn't experienced enough, and it was a huge expectation on him. But I remember reading when he took the job, he said, "I've had to tell my wife that this comes first. It's a 24-hour-a-day job." And I thought, is that being selfish or is that being ruthlessly ambitious?
I think it's being very unrealistic in this day and age. It's the 21st century.
Yeah.
No man, no woman has the right to say to their partner, the job comes before you do. If you get married to somebody or if you're living as married with somebody, your relationship comes first.
Yeah.
It has to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Otherwise, there's no point being in it.
No, I totally agree with that. I totally agree with that. And perhaps that's one of the reasons why I've never actually got into, a lasting relationship, but more of that later. Ed Sheeran, right? Great guy, Ed Sheeran. And I've got a lot of time for him. He's built this estate in Suffolk because that's where he comes from. He's an Ipswich boy. Alan Brazil, my, partner in crime on many things that we do, played for Ipswich. And so we've been there sometimes. And Ed Sheeran has been about. He's a very natural lad. It's just that I don't appreciate his music. I think all his songs sound the same. But anyway, in fairness to him, he defended himself recently against an accusation that he'd stolen somebody else's song. He'd stolen either the words or the melody or something like that. He fought the case and won it. And he came out of court and said, look, people have got to understand, there's only about 12 notes or chords in music. So obviously some records are going to sound similar to others that have been written in the past. And I thought, well, if it's that easy, why can't we all do it?
Well, it's the age-old debate, isn't it? I do think the judge made the right decision in this case.
Yeah.
But I also disagree with him. He's completely wrong about there being only 12 notes, chords, whatever it is. And it's not, of course, the argument isn't about chords because there's an almost infinite number of chords. But it's about chord progressions. And a lot of people say, what's a chord progression? It's, I suppose, the most famous one that we talk about is the 12-bar blues progression. And it's really about that. And because we always talk about the Beatles on this podcast,
of course we do,
whether people like it or not, the Beatles were obsessed with learning new chords and incorporating them into their songwriting. They were famous, especially for using very complex chord structures. And what fascinates me about that, and I know that you're very interested in this as well, they didn't study musical theory at all. They never learned music theory, and their music was so inventive because they were obsessed with chords and chord progressions, and they were guided just simply by their ears.
Was that their genius then? Was their genius their ability to manipulate chords? I don't even know what a chord is, but,
Well, it's a combination of three or more keys or notes. If you imagine that, well, you don't have to imagine, there are 88 keys on a piano keyboard.
Right.
And a chord is any three or more of those keys played at the same time. So if you put your hand down on a keyboard and just go 1, 2, 3, 4 with different fingers and press them all down at the same time, that is a chord.
I see.
And somebody worked out there are something like 109,000 possible chords.
Golly.
If you count the inversions as different chords. So it's a lot. It's not exactly infinite, but it's a real lot. But of course, every now and again, somebody's going to play chords with a new song that they've written that's going to remind some people of something that has been played before.
Absolutely.
We all hear things, don't we, on the radio sometimes.
George,
and think, that reminds me of something.
Yeah, go on. Oh, yes.
When you hear a song.
George Harrison paid out, didn't he? Because he was sued by somebody who said, you nicked the opener to My Sweet Lord from my record.
Oh, She's So Fine.
Oh, that's right. Was that the Ronettes or something?
Was it the Crystals or the Ronettes?
Was
it a Phil Spector song? I can't remember.
I think it was. And talking about Phil Spector, you've just said that the Beatles relied on their ears. There was an occasion, famous occasion once, I think it was it in your book? I read it in some Beatles book, where John Lennon's in the studio and Phil Spector suddenly pulls out a gun and fires it off in the studio and shoots a bullet in the roof. And Lennon turned to him and said, Phil, don't do that. Don't do that, please. He said, I don't mind if you shoot me, but don't burst my eardrums. I need them. Which backs up everything you've just said. It was all by instinct.
All about the ears.
Yeah.
The thing is about harmonies. I mean, I'm just such a big fan of harmonies, so many of us are.
Yeah.
And harmonies are an extremely complex thing. Mm. And the very best songwriters have a complete instinct for them. Mm. And that instinct can only have been picked up from all the music they were exposed to when they were kids. Mm. If you think John Lennon's mother, his mother Julia, who he didn't live with, he lived with Auntie Mimi, but Julia, he used to go and visit when he was a young teenager.
Yeah.
She had a gramophone.
Julia, he wrote a song
about
it, didn't
he? Yeah.
Mm.
She had a gramophone and she had a massive record collection and she used to play him all the stuff. That was his early exposure.
Yeah.
And Paul McCartney's father, of course, was a musician.
He was in band,
so all of Yeah, he had his own band.
Band, yeah.
And the piano that he learned on was, well, it was in that house in Fourth Lynn Road, Liverpool, for a long, long time. And then Paul moved it. He moved his father to a new house in the Wirral.
Right.
And that piano ended up in his dad's house. And Paul still has that house as well.
Wow, does he? On the Wirral?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I don't know whereabouts in the Wirral.
But our locals there have said Paul goes there quite often.
Wow.
And you see him bombing around down to the baker's shop and things like this in a little old mini that he keeps in his dad's garage.
God, isn't that amazing? I never knew that. Talk about Beatles, and this literally did shock me. You know, and I try to read most of the newspapers most days, and some newspapers have these columns, you know, telling you whose birthday it is today. I nearly fell off my breakfast stool when I read that Julian Lennon is now 59. I mean, what?
It's incredible, isn't it? I mean,
utterly incredible.
He's almost 20 years older than his father was when he was killed.
Yes, yes, you're absolutely right. He'd be 60 next year, Julian Lennon.
Yeah.
And I've told the story before about how I covered a court case once when he was living with his mother, Cynthia, in North Wales, and he and a few mates went out and smoked a bit of pot and broke down somebody's fence to light a fire over which they were cooking bacon or something like that. You know, but anyway, that's all in the past. But my God, I you know, where have the years gone? You have to say to yourself when that sort of thing happens. Now,
what is amazing, by the way, is Julian's just released his own recording of Imagine, his father's song.
Has he?
Having said for donkey's years that he would never record Imagine because that song is so indelibly linked to John that nobody else can really sing that song. But he's done it. Mm. And I watched a bit on YouTube. You should look it up.
Really?
It's uncannily. He sounds so uncannily like his father.
Is he playing a piano or a guitar?
No, he's singing and he's got a guitarist sitting beside him.
Oh, I see.
Playing along, sort of accompanying him.
Oh, amazing.
But Julian is singing the song so passionately.
Yeah.
It's really worth a look.
Absolutely. One of the few musicians who I've really, you know, warmed to since the dearth of the Beatles. I mean, obviously, they're all the greats, you know, David Bowie and Queen and Rolling Stones, I suppose. But the only new sort of wave that I ever took to was Oasis, okay? Because I think they did create a new sound, striking guitar chords and all that kind of stuff, the great singing of Liam Gallagher. Noel Gallagher wrote all the songs. And talking about Noel Gallagher, I was very interested to read that he doesn't have any problem hiding his wealth or how privileged he is in life, because recently something happened in his house. I think it was either a short circuit or the electric systems needed, you know, replacing or something like that. And so instead of doing what most people would do and go and rent a place for a couple of weeks or months, he moved to Claridge's with all his family. I think that's his wife and two kids. And, you know, costing £1,000 a night for each of them, he didn't seem to mind and said, I enjoy having afternoon tea in Claridge's. Why shouldn't I? I've worked hard enough during my life. I think that's quite a refreshing attitude.
I suppose it is. It's interesting because a friend of mine is the director of communications for the Barclay Hotel, the Connaught and Claridge's.
Mm.
So she does all the comms for those three hotels as a group.
Mm-hmm.
They're owned by the same umbrella company. And in fact, I've always thought that Claridge's is the best hotel in London.
Yeah.
Maybe in parallel with the Savoy, which is such a lovely hotel as well.
I agree.
And of course, we spent a lot of time in the Savoy when we were young. Mm. I don't want people to take that the wrong way. Not together, not in the same room.
No, absolutely.
But quite often together in the American bar on the ground floor.
Definitely.
And so I'd sort of toss up between, is Claridge's better? Is the Savoy better? Yeah. So I had to have a little look at this and see which is the most expensive hotel in the UK.
Right.
Can you guess?
The most expensive, I bet you it's one in Park Lane, but I can't remember the name of it now. Is it the Oriental?
You're very close. It's the Mandarin Oriental.
Thank you. Mandarin Oriental, yeah. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Which is the most expensive. I would have thought the Dorchester, actually.
The Dorchester, but I passed it the other day in a taxi going up Park Lane, and it looks like it's at the moment closed down for refurbishment, the Dorchester.
Okay.
Well, certainly the front of it is, anyway, yeah.
Right. Something else I found out, which I didn't know before, and this is quite interesting. Hotel rooms are valued by their square footage.
Yes.
So you can tell which is the most chic hotel to stay in, yeah, by knowing the fact that the Mandarin Oriental charges out at £9.10 per square foot.
Right. Okay.
The Barclay is £8.84 per square foot. Mm. The Connaught, £7.93.
Yeah.
And the Royal Suite at Claridge's, which probably is the one Noel Gallagher has because it's the best one, £7.64 a square foot.
Right.
But what's great about that suite, it's got four rooms.
Right.
It's got an original Gilbert and Sullivan piano.
Yes.
And a hand-painted gold-foiled wall dedicated to the Queen.
Wow.
and its own round-the-clock butler.
Wow.
I mean, we could probably put up with that, couldn't we?
Yeah, you certainly could. My favourite hotel in the world is the Essex House Hotel on Central Park South, because...
Oh, I love that hotel, yeah.
I do. I stayed there once and I took a suite. I don't know how I got the suite. Maybe I got upgraded or something, you know, or whatever. And I stayed for 3 days and I just had party after party after party. All my mates in New York, I said, look, not going anywhere today except the Essex House. Come over. Oh, what are you going to do, Mike? Just stand around your bed drinking. I said, no. Come over here and you'll see. And it had three rooms. It had a lounge, it had a dressing room, and it had a bedroom. And, of course, a couple of bathrooms, you know. And
Did you take up residence on the bed and invite people in to kind of pay court?
Not exactly, Miss Jones. I held court in the lounge, of course, you know, which was a nice spacious lounge, a couple of couches. And they were so good. I said, look, I'm having a few friends around. And I said, look, I don't want to deceive you and all that, but I don't want to pay hotel prices for bottles of champagne. They said, no problem. Ask the porter. He'll go to the, you know, the what they call the off-license.
The local offie.
The local offie. Yeah. This way. He said he'll go around to the...
Are you serious?
I'm absolutely serious. He said he'll go around to the liquor store for you. It was around the corner and get you a case. I said, okay, thanks very much. So he did. And they were so good, they filled the bath up with ice and let me put my 12 bottles of champagne in the bath to keep it cold. And I thought that was excellent service, you know?
Well, I mean, the thing is, they're getting you paying top dollar in the Essex House Hotel, aren't they?
Yeah.
It is a nice hotel. I tell you, the other one I really love in New York is the library.
Is the what? The library?
The library. You ever stayed there?
Yeah, where's that?
It's a little bit further uptown and Upper West Side, I think.
Yeah, the Upper West Side, yeah.
It's got all the rooms are sort of literary themed.
Oh, that sounds great. Because if you just take an average hotel in New York, and I mean Midtown, you know what I mean? The great disappointment is that whilst it looks great at the entrance and the foyer and the bar downstairs and the restaurant, the rooms are tiny, aren't they? It's all about square footage that you've just talked about. The rooms,
yeah, they are tiny, and also they tend to be a bit on the shabby side.
I totally agree with you. Not only are they tiny, they're shabby, and there's chip paint, and the carpets look as though they could be replaced and all that. But they don't care in New York. It's all about image from the front, and once you're in and they've got you, that's your problem.
I tell the other thing. My pet. I have two pet hates about hotels. I don't really like staying in hotels very much because I'm a bit of a hygiene freak, and I hate pillows that smell of other people's heads. You know that sort of head smell that you get.
That's absolutely disgraceful. I know. That's terrible.
I know that they change the pillowcases and they change the liners.
Yeah, but they don't change the pillow, do they?
No, and the pillow is one that hundreds of other people have slept on.
I know,
And the other thing is those counterpanes that they put over the bed, over the top of the bedding.
Yeah.
And people lie on those without their shoes on, with their stinky feet.
No, I just chuck it straight to the floor. Never again, I'll take
straight in the wardrobe.
I'll take the first cover off the bed, fold it up, put it in the corner, and that's it for me. This episode is brought to you by Surfshark. The internet is getting more dangerous by the second. Hackers have more ways to target you. Trackers are following your every move. And malware is hiding all over the web. But luckily, there is a solution. You can get a VPN. It will handle your real location, making you more difficult to identify and to target. But privacy and security are not all that Surfshark has to offer. If you use a VPN, you will forget about geo restrictions, okay? You'll be able to access everything from news sources to social media apps that are unavailable to you because of your location. Now, just change your virtual location and access all the entertainment you want safely and very securely. And you can try out Surfshark completely risk-free because they have a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get Surfshark VPN at surfshark.deals/Porky, okay? Use the promo code Porky for 83% off and 3 extra months free. So that's surfshark.deals/Porky. Right, okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Portmeister, and Miss Leslie Ann Jones, fresh back from her travels in Fiorentina. What was it? No, it wasn't Fiorentina, was it, Miss Jones? It was.
Florence. Which the Italians call Firenze.
Firenze, that's right, yeah. And here you are. Now, what do you think, Miss Jones, about the fact that I have got Wayne Rooney's first ever England shirt on the wall of my office stroke studio as I talk to you? It says England versus Australia, 12th of the 2nd, 2003. Best wishes, Wayne Rooney. Okay. Because the reason I'm asking you that is that you may not have been aware whilst you were away that a story emerged that Steve Hodge, who was an average kind of footballer, but played for England. I think he played for Nottingham Forest, England. Might have played for Spurs, but I think it was Nottingham Forest in England. And at the end of a classic game in which Maradona scored the hand of God goal against Peter Shilton and beat us 3-1, Steve Hodge swapped shirts with Maradona at the end, number 10 Maradona's shirt is. That shirt is now going up for auction, and it's been on loan to the National Football Museum for the last 20 years. Steve's now decided to sell it, and it's estimated to be able to raise a sum of £6 million.
You're joking.
No, £6
million. Good God. Now, so how have you got Rooney's shirt?
I'll tell you, I got Rooney's shirt. It was in an auction, right, because one of his major sponsors was McDonald's. So McDonald's organised a football dinner, and these football dinners make most of their money by auctioning football memorabilia around the room. Do you see what I mean? Bits here, bits there, bits and all that. The McDonald's people were so kind. They were big fans of TalkSport, who I was working for at the time. And they got a hold of me in advance and said, we've got Wayne Rooney's England shirt, the first one he's ever worn. Do you want to make a bid? And I said, yes, I definitely do. So I put in a sealed bid, right? There was nothing crooked about this at all. I put in a sealed bid, and on the night, I didn't go to the dinner. I couldn't go to the dinner. It was in the north of England, and I was working every morning in the south. And I was delighted to get a call the next morning to say, nobody outbid your sealed bid. I bid 1,750 quid, right? And the reason was nobody could foresee how great Rooney was going to become. You see what I mean? He was only a kid. He was only 17 when he made his debut for England. But I knew he would be, and also he played for Everton, and I was an Everton fan. So that shirt remains with me. I don't think I'll ever get 6 million for it, but I wouldn't sell it anyway, to be honest. But isn't it amazing the way that these things can happen? Steve Hodge never knew it was going to be 6 million quid when he took the shirt literally off Madonna's back and took it home with him.
What do you think your Rooney shirt is worth now?
Right, well, let's be absolutely honest here. What happens is when an England player plays for England, there are three shirts on the peg that he get in the dressing room where he goes to get changed, okay? And it's usually one for the first half, one for the second half, and the third one you can do what you like with. You see what I mean? You can keep it and take it home. Steven Gerrard's got a huge collection of shirts in his home from all the great games he's played in, and he puts them on mannequins. And it's fantastic because the mannequins.
How did you say that word?
Sorry?
How did you say that
mannequins?
Word?
Yeah, yeah.
What? Mannequins, I think.
Oh, are they mannequins? Oh, I thought mannequins. Yeah. Oh, they're spelled with a Q. But
that's so cute. Mannequins, really mannequins. Sweet okay. Say that.
But it's so incredible because he's got them in glass sort of cupboards, you know, glass cases, right? And there's a light on them, and he has the mannequin revolves. So you see the front of the shirt and the back of the shirt. You see what I mean? It's absolutely spectacular. He's very proud of his career, and he's kept all his shirts. I've just got mine in a frame on the wall. I'd never sell it anyway. But what I'm saying is my shirt is the third shirt. You see what I mean? So I can't claim to anybody that Wayne Rooney wore this shirt when he played in his first international because it's probably untrue. It's a very clean...
I'll tell you what my dad had there.
Oh, yeah.
My dad had one of Bobby Charlton's England... Wow. 66 World Cup final shirts.
Oh, golly, that's incredible. Really?
Yeah.
And what's happened to it?
Bobby gave it to him because they were friends all their lives, really. Mm. And my father gave it to my brother.
Has your brother still got it?
As far as I know.
Golly, that's amazing. Well, that is...
Unless he sold it, because my brother's very rich, so he probably didn't need to sell it.
No, I doubt if he would. I think Bobby played number 9, didn't he, for England, as I recall. Because Jeff Hurst was number 10, so it must have been, yeah, yeah. Because it was only 1 to 11 in those days. These days, of course, footballers can play.
I tell you what happened, though, and this probably devalued it to quite some extent.
Right.
My mother washed it.
Oh, no.
She put it in the washing machine with all the other stuff. You know.
No.
Yeah.
And
which I don't think you're supposed to do, are
of
you?
Of course it's not. A, it's a red shirt, so it would have, you know...
Well, it ran. It ran. I remember it ran over all our school socks.
I was about to
and
say.
In those days, we had to wear... This is getting personal here, but family show. We had to wear 2 pairs of pants to school.
Right.
We had to wear knickers, okay? So we had to wear white knickers, which were known as liners.
Yeah.
And then we had to wear navy blue knickers over the top of the liners.
Yes.
So all the white knickers that went in with Bobby Charlton's shirt and all our white school socks all came out pink.
See, I can imagine the PE teacher, right, a week later saying, Leslie Ann, why are your knickers pink and not white? And you said, because my mum put them in the wash with Bobby Charlton's shirt.
Exactly.
Imagine that.
Exactly. Yeah. And of course, nobody believed you. You know, you might as well not come out with anything like that. Because
Absolutely. Now, what is the madness inside the brains, Miss Jones, of Amber Heard and Johnny Depp, that having... literally expose themselves to the world as two pretty vile people in a high court case in which they were sort of suing and counter-suing. They're now doing it all over again in California. What kind of madness? And by the way, they've already budgeted legal fees on either side for $20 million.
Well, first of all, I would like to say they could have saved Ukraine with this money.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we are all keeping... President Putin afloat.
Yes.
By, you know, we've said this sanction and that sanction, we kick Abramovich out, all these little things that we do, but we're still buying their gas and oil. Mm. So we're still pouring billions of dollars worth of rubles, I suppose he insists on now, into their economy. Yeah. So we're all keeping him afloat. Amber Heard and Johnny Depp between them could have done this rather than waste money on a completely pointless court case. Mm. The reason that it's happening now in America is because he lost it in the UK. Mm. It was madness of him to sue the Sun in the first place. The Sun is, yes, for its reasonable reach, I suppose, these days. Mm. It is only a tabloid newspaper.
Yes, it is.
Paper. And people read it one day, they eat their fish and chips off it, figuratively speaking,
indeed,
the next.
Indeed.
No one cares. Yeah. But because they mounted this huge court hearing and he lost, he's not going to let that lie. He has to then try and get his own back by bringing another case against her in America.
Yeah.
So all of this money, I'm coming back as a lawyer, I tell you, all of this money is basically going down the toilet to prove what? You know, Dan Wharton said he was a wife beater. There is evidence to support the suggestion that he has been a wife beater.
Yeah.
He may not be an inherent wife beater. Mm. She may be the only wife he ever beat. Mm. But he certainly hurt her. Mm. There was plenty of evidence that was accepted
like a bruised lip or something,
to demonstrate that.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
So what is he trying to prove now?
God knows.
That he's got more money than sense is the bottom line. And this is going to, it already has actually dragged out more salacious gossip and unpleasant dealings between the pair of them than we even had to put up with during the first hearing.
I know, it's amazing. Is it also amazing that you know, there's a band of people who are so dedicated and loyal to Johnny Depp, despite the evidence they've heard in the London High Court case, that they forgive him for everything. It's so bizarre, isn't it? Hero worship.
Well, it is. It's a bit like rock stars, isn't it? I mean, some of the stuff that's gone down over the years, but people will not have a word said against them. You know, look at all the people that support Bill Wyman, for example.
That's right.
And hero worship him because he's once been a Rolling Stone for all those years. Yeah. But, I mean, quite frankly, we know what he did and we know how old Mandy Smith was when it happened.
I totally agree. Listen, I read a great story that the think tank is on the way back now for the benefit of our
millions. The drink tank, you mean?
Yeah, the drink tank, yeah. Of course, think tanks are where all the senior executives from the paper or the radio station or the TV station go off to a country house hotel and allegedly, you know, it's a brainstorming session, come back with a collection of brand sparkling new ideas to reinvigorate the product. I've been to loads of think tanks, as I'm sure you have. Never, ever, ever did we ever come back with a sparkling new idea. We came back feeling ill because it was a 3 or 4 day beano with loads of drink, tons of food, you know, long lunches, long dinners and all that, and simply no ideas. I remember we went to one in Le Touquet, right, and in France, and they say that the think tank is now getting even more lavish and people are flying their, you know, their executives out to Mallorca and all this because they haven't been able to do it for the last 2 years. I remember one in Le Touquet, and it was cut short when we were on about the third day of it, and the editor, Sir Nick, was only playing golf. That's the only reason he went there. It's got a great golf course and all that. When the news came through that Robert Maxwell had disappeared off his yacht in the Mediterranean, which so rocked the newspaper world, you know, in terms of share prices and sustainability and the mystery of what happened, that we all went back to London at the behest of the chairman of Express Newspapers, Lord somebody or other, who had been tipped off that there was more to this than meets the eye. And from that moment, the whole Maxwell scandal unfolded.
Yeah, just it's so bizarre.
And the reason I say that and link this Le Touquet thing to Maxwell is there's been a series of programmes on the Maxwell family, three of them. And at first I thought, I'm not going to watch those. I know all about Maxwell anyway. My God, I was shaken absolutely to the core because they didn't just do it on Ghislaine, who, of course, is waiting in jail to be sentenced for the heinous crimes, you know, against young girls. They went right back to the start of where Robert Maxwell came from. The fact that, you know, he escaped the Second World War, purgatory, you know, being Jewish and all that kind of stuff, and rose to be a communications, you know, giant around the world, they called him. But, of course, it was all built on sand because it collapsed and he became a massive crook. But they tried to link the rise of Robert Maxwell and the effect it had on his daughter, Ghislaine, who after he named the yacht after, Lady Ghislaine, of which he disappeared, and the incredibly weird relationship they had. And it was absolutely fantastically riveting for somebody like me and you, you know, grew up in Fleet Street, to see the way Maxwell operated, spoke to his other people, but of course, eventually stole your father's pension.
Absolutely stole my father's pension. He never got a whiff of it back. Yeah. He'd worked for the Mirror Group for 42 years and walked away with absolutely nothing. Did they touch on that terrible but fascinating story about how he came down one Christmas morning in the early hours and there was a huge Christmas tree in the hallway with hundreds of presents for all the children all stacked around the base of the tree and he ripped open every single last one of them.
Golly.
Stealing the children's Christmas morning and that sort of visit from Father Christmas just because he had to have all the benefit and the attention for himself.
No, they didn't.
And broke the hearts of all his kids. There were lots of them, weren't there? About six, I think.
That's all the stories. They opened my eyes on Ghislaine. I mean, you know, Ghislaine's defence, I was only, Jeffrey, what's his name? Epstein's. I was only Epstein's assistant. I don't know. This documentary claimed, and it was very well researched, that, sometimes she had to supply 3 underage girls a day for Jeffrey Epstein, depending on where they were, New York or one of his islands. It was so prolific. It was unbelievable, you know. But I don't know.
What causes a person to stoop so low? How dependent on Jeffrey Epstein, was she? That she had to do this kind of thing, that she had to debase herself.
Yeah. What was so interesting was they for the first time, they revealed to me the link. And that was that Robert Maxwell, when he was plundering his money, needed Jeffrey Epstein to launder it. That's what Jeffrey Epstein did for a living. He laundered vast fortunes for people from the Middle East to South America to China, and hid their money and took huge percentages and all that kind of stuff. And Robert Maxwell was one of his clients. So when Maxwell died, she escaped to New York, got in touch with Epstein, told him who he was, and he took her under his wing. I think they were boyfriend and girlfriend for a bit, but then she just became, like, you know, useful to him and all that kind of stuff. But look, it's an amazing story. I want to talk to you also, Miss Jones, about the reunion of Jennifer Lopez and Ben Affleck. This is amazing. 18 years ago, they nearly got married but then split up. Now they're back together. I think that's a really romantic tale.
No. Never, ever, ever, ever go back to somebody that you broke up with. It can never work. Because whatever was wrong with the relationship in the past is still wrong. That person is still the same person. Yeah. You are still the same person. Whatever the fault line was, it hasn't been repaired, because it can't be. It's all about human personalities. And I think this is a very dangerous thing to do. I would never do it myself. I've seen people do it who've remarried partners that they divorced in the past. And then, of course, in fact, my cousin Kevin did this very thing. He divorced Julie, who he had a couple of kids with years and years ago. He got back with her quite recently, a couple of years back, and they've just separated again.
Yeah, well, that's
because it just, you know, whatever was wrong is still wrong. And I would fear for this relationship. I really would.
Well, maybe after 18 years, they each realised they didn't find anybody as attractive as they had found each other attractive 18 years ago and tried to get back. I've got a case in point here, right? My first girlfriend, first proper girlfriend, if you see what I mean, long-term relationship, was a lady called Trudy. And we broke up when I was 21. We were together for 5 years. I met her at a college dance. We were together for 5 years. And then I realised that I'd started in journalism, I was on the Chester Chronicle, but I wanted to go so much further. And I very, very selfishly decided that as a single man, I would be more employable, I'd be more mobile, I'd be able to move more quickly, not just between jobs, but off on stories at short notice and all this kind of stuff without any domestic responsibilities. So I ended it. But in the last couple of years, if Trudy came back into my life, I'd want to restart it again. And, you know, I don't believe that I've wasted all the years in between. I had to go to get on with my job. I had a good life. I had a successful career. I know it was terribly selfish, but I think if I'd have decided to make it formal with Trudy, it would have broken up, because, I would always have put the job first wherever I was. So I decided to just go my own way. But I would... If Trudy walked into my life again tomorrow, I'd want to restart it immediately.
When was the last time you saw her?
About 35 years ago, I think.
Don't you think that she might have got fat and old and lumpy?
No. I went 10 years without seeing her, you know, from sort of 21 to the age of about 31. And then I saw her again. And it was because I was in Chester and somebody had mentioned to me that they knew where Trudy was and all that kind of stuff. And we met and had a cup of coffee or something, and she had a child. She'd married a guy who ran, he was a golf professional or something. And, she looked exactly the same at 31 that she had at 21. And I believe she would look exactly the same now.
But, you know, she'd be in her 60s now, and women in their 60s do look rather different from women in their 30s.
Well, Joan Collins
didn't.
You do know this. Joan Collins didn't. And...
Well, Joan Collins, bless her heart, she's my role model, but Joan Collins is a mass of wigs and makeup.
Yeah, well, you know.
Take all that off, darling, and she's not going to look like Joan Collins, is she?
No, Trudy would have looked after herself. I have to admit that I think one of the reasons that, you know, one of the things I've been hoping for, because I've been doing national radio for 20 years. And last couple of years, I've done a lot more television, which is broadcast nationally. And I've done theatre tours for 3 years in towns all over Britain. And I've secretly been waiting for the call from Trudy to say, I saw you on the television. I heard you on the radio. You were in my town on the stage and some of my friends went to see you. I've been waiting for that call, but it's never come.
Are you still in love with
her? Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and that's why I never got...
Oh, well, we can't allow this to go on. We have to... Trudy, darling, if you're listening to this podcast, or if one of Trudy's friends is listening to this podcast, or a family member or somebody, my email address is on the website, okay? LeslieAnnJones.com. Go there, send me an email, tell me where Trudy is. If you can't bring yourself to reach out to Mike directly, please contact me and let's see if we can do something about this. This is the greatest love story of broadcasting and it's never been fulfilled. I have to try and make this happen for you, Mike.
Well, if you can, Leslie, and I'd be very grateful. Thank you very much indeed.
Trudy, get hold of me and let's see if we can hook you guys up. And I will be the maid of honour.
Well, that's very kind of you, Miss Jones. And I think on that romantic moment, we will say cheerio to the audience today. And we'll be back with you next week. My favourite hotel in the world is the Essex House Hotel on Central Park South. Because
I love that hotel, yeah.
I do. I stayed there once and I took a suite. I don't know how I got the suite. Maybe I got upgraded or something, you know, or whatever. And I stayed for 3 days. And I just had party after party after party. All my mates in New York, I said, look, not going anywhere today except the Essex House. Come over. Oh, what are you going to do, Mike? Just stand around your bed drinking? I said, no, come over here and you'll see. And it had three rooms. It had a lounge, it had a dressing room, and it had a bedroom. And, of course, a couple of bathrooms, you know. And
Did you take up residence on the bed and invite people in to kind of pay court?
Not exactly, Miss Jones. I held court in the lounge, of course, you know, which was a nice spacious lounge, a couple of couches. One of the things I've been hoping for, because I've been doing national radio for 20 years, the last couple of years I've done a lot more television, which is broadcast nationally, and I've done theatre tours for 3 years in towns all over Britain, and I've secretly been waiting for the call from Trudy to say, I saw you on the television, I heard you on the radio, you were in my town on the stage, and some of my friends went to see you. I've been waiting for that call, but it's never come.
Are you still in love with
her? Yeah, definitely. Why are your knickers pink and not white? And you said, because my mum put them in the wash with Bobby Charlton's shirt.